I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 9 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jim O'Kane. What can I say about Jim? Wow, I don't know. There's just so much to say that I just won't say anything. Welcome back, Jim.
Oh, that's I'm very grateful. Yes, yes. Maintain the silence.
I'm not trying to maintain silence.
I appreciate. And plus, if you can't maintain silence, if people listen to your podcast. But thanks again for having me on. This has been a wonderful week. You know, for It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes. Because you know, it's just you never just don't know what to say about Jim.
Usually, it's ruefully shaking people's heads. Just oh boy,
but it could be.
It's been a great time here. I really enjoyed this. This movie is so built for the movies by minutes format. There's so many things to stare at. You really need to slow down and just go through all the stuff. There's so many shots in this particular minute that we're looking at. I mean, a lot of editing, a lot of tight shots and zooms and opticals. And so this minute 9 should be a really good plow through of how Capra gets the job done.
Yeah. Completely. I mean, we talked yesterday about the fact of how Capra is a great visual storyteller, and this minute is another perfect example of that, of how he does that. You know, what's the famous quote from True Romance? You know, you have a scene where a character basically says, what we have here is we're playing a game of show and tell. You're telling me nothing, but you're showing me everything.
Uh-huh. You know? Yes. Yeah, there's just so many things in here where it's wordless, but we're getting the idea of it is almost a silent movie here where we're seeing clues to what's going on, and a little bit on the nose with explaining some of the details in here, but
it's
very effective.
Yes,
and you can enjoy it that way.
So. Mm-hmm. And so, minute 9 begins with Gower giving George an assignment, and ends with George ascending the steps of the building alone. So yesterday
second
we
floor.
That's right, which we will get to about that.
Yes.
Also, there is a slight problem with that, but we'll talk about that more tomorrow than today. But you know, we'll keep people in suspense about that one, and. So yesterday we ended things with Gower, you know, in his drunken stupor, because you know we know that he's upset about his son, you know, dying from the from COVID, from the COVID 1.0. I don't know.
Yes, 20th century COVID. Yes,
20th century, early 20th century COVID. Yeah, and so he puts these pills, or tries to put pills in a pill box, and he drops a whole bunch on the ground. George says he'll pick them up, which he doesn't. And then Gower basically shoots him out and says, get out of here, because Mrs. Blaine needs to, get those capsules. She's waiting for them. And he says, yes, sir. And then, you know, he agrees to go. George is very amicable to everything that Gower requests of him. You know, Gower treats him like crap, and George just says, okay, great, no problem. Yes, of course. I'll do what you want. No problem. You know, apparently he needs the money to be able to buy all those shoelaces.
Wow, yes.
or something else. I don't know. Maybe he needs the money to be able to pay for his National Geographic subscription.
Subscription. That's true. Yeah. But I mean, when he's going to get his harem, you have to think about how many 2-cent packs of licorice he's going to need to develop that harem.
Well, again, as we talked about yesterday, harem just means women in the household. So he sort of has one at home with Annie and his mother. You know,
yeah.
you can already state from that perspective. You know, and the whole idea here also is that, you know, he's a very smart kid. He's able, you can already see at this age, at the age of 12, that he's able to figure things out. You know, that maybe it's because he's reading National Geographic all the time. I don't know. You know, and I would think also that, you know, I mentioned earlier that he needs the money in order maybe to buy his subscription. To me, Peter Bailey does sound like the type of father that would want to instill in his son, you know, how important money is. And you know, what you can get with your money, that he would make him pay for his own subscription to National Geographic if that's what he wants. You know, he would show him the proper economical way, you know, to save your money for things that are important and you know, so that you can get, you know, magazines in brown paper bags.
Maps of where to find the coconuts.
There you go.
Yeah, it's interesting, but he's, you know, of course, you know, he could have had a job as a pharmacist, I guess, but, you know, being in Gower's place, he already knows how to make ice cream floats and things like that, and he obviously knows inventory too, but that was not where he was going. He was going to be an adventurer, so
that's right.
His on the job training went nowhere.
and then, you know, we see Gower like stagger away and go behind some shelves. And first of all, this is great cinematography because, you know, they don't move the camera, but he moves behind a shelf filled with all these different types of medicines and tonics and
potions.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, again, I think there is a connection between the Harry Potter world and, you know, and the It's a Wonderful Life world. I mean, we talked earlier in the week about the Back to the Future connection, but, you know, Harry Potter fits in here also. Forget about the fact that Henry Potter's real name is Harry Potter. You know, that's a separate issue. But I'm saying just the fact that it looks like they're just dealing with all of these, you know, potions. I mean, you can even read some of them. There's one that says Pekinch Rub, or Peach. Is that Peach Rub?
Yeah. PV Cinch Rub. I don't.
Something like that. I wasn't able to find out what that is. But
it's probably some kind of coconut extract or something.
Or peach extract or something like that. You know, but we see Gower.
Cinch Rub.
That's right. We see Gower go behind, you know, a row of shelves filled with all these different potions and bottles and stuff like that. And the camera doesn't move. And he goes to the row behind and sits down in a chair. And lovingly looks at a picture, which we all assume is his son, Robert. I mean, I wasn't able to find out who that is a real picture of, you know, if that's H.B. Warner's son or some other actor. It's maybe Frank Capra's kid. I don't know.
Yeah, it's and I was trying to figure out how old is Gower and how, I mean, his son looks a little old for college, but maybe he was teaching there instead of being a student. I don't know.
That's right. We don't really know what happened. It didn't say he died while he was studying. It just said he died while he's here. So maybe he was a teacher.
Yeah. It's he just doesn't seem I guess there's no picture of Mrs. Gower. I don't see anything. So maybe it was he was, you know, a single dad. This was his only family.
Ooh, he'd fit into your website.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, unfortunately, it wasn't on TV, but yeah, he.
Come on, this was on TV more than a lot of TV shows.
Yeah, it only had one episode though. It needs more than one episode.
Ah, okay. That's one of the criteria.
Yeah, it has to be. You can't have a special. Is one of my rules. Oh,
okay.
Single dad. They have to be a series. There was a single dad show on ABC called Wonderland. And they filmed 13 episodes, but they only aired one of them, and the ratings were so bad on ABC they canceled. It was a two-part pilot episode that they were showing, and the ratings were so bad they never showed part two of the opening episode. So It was, but you know, and so I had held it off my website for a while, but then they had syndicated it in Sweden, so somewhere in the world it played, and I put it back on my website. But yeah, trying to get that second episode out is always important.
Yeah. When did that come out? When was it? Was that like an 80s show?
1999, I believe. Or no, 1990. Excuse me, 1990. Or no, it has to be later than that. 1999.
With Shirley Henderson?
No, it was.
No, that's a movie that came out.
No, it's called Wonderland. It was originally going to be named Bellevue, but Bellevue Hospital it was about a mental hospital, but Bellevue Hospital said they would sue ABC if they used the word Bellevue in the title, so they changed the name of the show to Wonderland. It was a group of doctors. Here it is, and if I can get into it, no, that's Gideon's Crossing. Wait,
what year is it?
It was, hang on, Wonderland premiered 2000, the year 2000. It was filmed in 1999. Filmed in the year 2000, and it
was... Oh, with Ted Levine. Oh, wow.
Yeah, the directly opposite ER, which was like, wow. You're going to premiere a medical drama up opposite ER. So it just, it fell apart really fast. I was fortunate enough to visit the set of Wonderland. It was filmed in
Peter Berg. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was filmed in Silver Cup Studios in Queens. And I interviewed the single dad on the show, who was played by Michael Jai White. So it's just amazing all-star cast. My son went with me to the press junket that I was on in this thing. And Michael Jai White took a liking to my son, because my son was asking, what does this do? What does that do? My son is always falling in love. He was in high school at the time, and he was always falling in love with PAs every time I would take him in later ones. They're always very pretty PAs. So he goes, can I go on another? Michael Jai White showed him a card trick that he was going to do in a movie. And he said, hey, do you like this? And so my son was a very appreciative audience. It was a great, great time being on the set. A lot of fun watching them film the 13th and unfortunately unaired in the U.S. Episode of Wonderland. We watched the season finale being shot.
And, the series finale.
Yeah. It was a shame. A great cast, and from what I saw from the acting, it was fantastic. They really did a great job, but unfortunately, too many issues with the topic, and just not enough people to watch it to overcome the topic. So
I was actually at that studio one. It was it's like a studio in Queens, isn't it?
Right, yeah, it's the old Silver Cup Bread Company. If you remember, when I was a kid, they used to sell Silver Cup Bread, great bread. I had many tuna fish sandwiches made on Silver Cup Bread. But then it turned into a movie studio, and it's really – I think it's the closest production facility outside of Manhattan to New York City. I mean, it's right there in Queens, and it's right over the bridge.
Yeah, so, I actually went to a taping of a TV show there once.
Cool.
In the beginning of January 2001 – there was a new TV show that was starting out with Jim Gaffigan.
Oh, wow.
Called Welcome to New York. And I happened to be in New York at the time. And, it's actually somewhat ironic. On that same day, I was meeting up with some friends, and we were like, okay, well, maybe we should go, to the World Trade Center today. And we're like, nah, we'll have plenty of time to go there. We'll go see this, we'll go watch this new show. We'll go to a live taping of it. So it was actually quite interesting. And we got to talk to some of the cast afterwards also and stuff like that. And I remember one of the actors in one of the background actors was a guy, and he was wearing a yarmulke, and he just kept moving back and forth and stuff like that. And afterwards, we went over to him, and we're like, oh, wow, what character are you playing? He goes, what do you think? I'm like, I don't know. He goes, I'm the producer. I'm like, okay.
Silver Cup is it's a great place. A nice, a really compact studio. I've been once in Hollywood, but the New York one is really amazing, because they have to fit a lot of they're filming simultaneous shows there, so a lot of the walls are wild. They can just like break down a set, film a bunch of stuff, put a different show in a matter of a day. Friends, I believe, was shot some of the seasons when they were doing New York scenes, when they would set up temporary stuff at Silver Cup. Most of it was shot in California, but if they needed to do location stuff in New York, they'd set up temporary sets there for friends. But yeah, it's a great little place right off the 59th Street Bridge there on the right hand side if you're heading to Queens. But anyway, I'm not sure how we wound up here, but it's definitely medical and single dad. But getting back to Mr. Gower, who's staggering around there in the background, just a great labyrinth. It just gives you an idea. It's his whole office area there is kind of muddled, just like his mind is kind of muddled.
Yeah.
And we're actually now, I'm the way I'm looking at this, this is from Mary's point of view.
You think so?
I think.
No, well, I don't. I don't think so.
No, she'd have the she'd have the frosted glass in front of her. So
that's
she
right.
See that?
So no, it's not Mary. Kind of. It's yeah. it's the omniscient present here that's
giving yes.
You know, and as he's sitting down, you see that there's like a typewriter right next to him. Also, you know, one of those old typewriters and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Now, I know you know about old stuff. So, how far back do you think typewriters go?
I would not know where the first typewriter was. I would think it would be back maybe in the 1700s?
1874.
Oh, wow, that late. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I know that the that particular typewriter that is using, the Underwood number 5, is almost like the number 2 pencil of typewriters. It was that number 5, they made millions and millions of them, and they were used everywhere. Secretaries, desks, people had them at home, students had them, teachers had them, and pharmacists had them, doctors had them. They were almost a universal it was something that everybody knew. So and that number 5, it's funny, even as they updated the Underwood, they made it better, the keys had better motions, different key services, they kept using the number 5 on later models just because people were so familiar with, I need an Underwood number 5 because I know how it works. Those original ones there, they were like the first 3 decades of the 1900s, that particular model that he has there. This was peak Underwood number 5 season. So he had it, probably Bailey Savings and Loan had it. Mr. Potter probably had a whole fleet of them at his offices. And it was just, it was the PC of its day. It was a thing that you sent out, not emails, but all your correspondence went through the roller of an Underwood number 5.
Right. Right. And so, I mean, the typewriters that we know of nowadays, that's what started in 1874. Before that, you had all these different other types of typewriters, or you know, there were precursors to the typewriters that weren't as efficient or effective as the ones that we have here. I mean, Remington only started their production on typewriters in the 1870s. It was in New York, in Ilion, New York, and that was actually when they
near outside of Schenectady, yeah.
Okay, and that was when they first started the whole idea of a QWERTY keyboard layout. You know, so and we still have the same layout, you know, 150 years later. So it's
if I remember correctly, it was QWERTY was built specifically to slow down typists because the letters would be in unusual spots so that they wouldn't jam the keys as they were typing.
Right, but from my perspective, I just think that's crazy that they would do it that way. You'd think that they would want to make it a more efficient. I mean, obviously, you have the whole problem if you press too many buttons, and I had this as a kid when I would use a typewriter, you know, that they would get stuck together because you pressed on too many of them at the same time. You know, I
overlap things.
That's right. I have that problem when I type now. You know, my mind moves slower than my hands sometimes, you know, and so I will type letters, sometimes words will come out backwards because of that.
Yes.
But at least on the computer, I don't have to worry about, you know, the strike keys getting tangled together where you need to have to try and do something to try and fix that.
It won't break the ribbon, so.
Right. Or the whiteout ribbon, which I always remember. I always loved that they had those, you know, basically – All it is it puts the whiteout directly, you know, the same letter the same exact design of the letter on a letter.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Or you'd have those little pieces of paper before the whiteout paint went in. You'd hold a little piece of paper with the white chalk on the front of it just to fix one or two.
That's right. I remember that also.
Nowadays, I guess you spend most of your time uncorrecting the autocorrect. That's not the word I meant. It was taxes, not Texas. So, yeah, it's a different world.
Yeah. Do you actually know the name of the person who created QWERTY and where?
I do not know that one.
A man called Christopher Latham Scholes, who was a newspaper editor and printer in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Ah, have to hunt him down.
Well, I don't know if you're going to have to find. I don't think he's going to be talking.
No, I think it's 1870. I just was wondering what his headstone looked like. If it's Here Lies QWERTY. Just very, very
interesting. I didn't even think about that fact. You know that his headstone says QWERTY on it. You know, it's like,
now I am currently looking at Find a Grave to see if I can find him. But he's in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Okay.
Yeah.
I will keep talking. I'll keep looking. But let me see if we can find out where he is buried.
He died in 1890, tuberculosis, and he's buried in Forest Home Cemetery in Milwaukee.
Ah, here he is. 1890, yes, there he is. And his he has a brass plaque, and on the plaque it says Christopher Latham Scholes, 1818 to 1890, the father of the typewriter, dedicated by the young men and women of America in grateful memory of one who materially aided in the world's progress.
Ooh, interesting.
I guess you could say he did really. I mean, when you think about how many people know how to type on a QWERTY keyboard, he really did have an effect on the future.
Yes.
So,
and the fact that it's still being used, you know, that's the standard. You know, so it goes according to what you said about the reason that they set it up this way is that he wanted to keep common combinations of letters farther apart.
Ah.
You know, in order to stop internal clashing, you know, as what we were talking about, you know, that if you press letters together, then something might get stuck.
I wonder what the original, like what he was working from. Usually, I mean, it's like the things when you bring up your flat screen TV and it wants to ask the search feature to type in the movie you're looking for. Sometimes they come up in QWERTY format, but most of the time they come up in alphabetical order.
Right.
So I was wondering if they had alphabetical order typewriters before QWERTY was developed.
Well, I don't think so, because I mean, this was basically developed around the same time that the typewriter was being developed. So,
I have a question. You being in Israel, what is the equivalent in Hebrew of a QWERTY keyboard?
Because we have a QWERTY keyboard, and every letter has a different Hebrew letter on it. And if you do Alt Shift, it switches between languages.
Okay, and it'll switch to right to left. As well as left to right, is there a key for
no.
that?
No, right. You need to there in you have to switch the you have to switch to right alignment instead of left alignment, stuff like that. Trust me, sometimes it's very difficult when you're trying. The most difficult thing is when you're typing something and then it switches on you. You know, I've had that where, you know, I'll be typing something in one language and it'll switch to another language and then it'll switch back. And then, so I actually have a program on my computer that all I have to do is highlight it doesn't matter which language, and then I press F10 and it automatically translates the keyboard back. Meaning, you know, if because when well, I'll be typing gibberish.
Yeah.
So it switches it back to the right thing.
Wow.
Yeah, and trust me, it happens very often. I'm constantly throughout the day you doing that, because sometimes I won't be looking at the keyboard and I'll be typing something, and it doesn't matter. Again, it doesn't matter which language I'm typing it in, and then I'll look at the screen and I'll be like, "Oh crap!" Highlight it.
You know, usually just after you hit send, and it's like, "Oh," and then just please ignore previous message.
I've done that. I've done that too. I've sent WhatsApp messages. you know, where it's just complete gibberish. And, you know, so for people who don't understand the language, we'll get even, you know, for them, they don't even know what the characters are. You know, they're getting really strange characters. You know, I have a friend that will always say, "I don't speak Chinese." He knows it's not Chinese, but he says that's his standard answer when he gets gibberish like that. You know, so.
Wow. All because of, it all started with Christopher Scholes.
There you go.
Intriguing. Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, he lovingly, Gower sits there transfixed by the picture of his son. But now that I think about it, I think you're right. I think his son must be a teacher.
You know? He's got a little gray in the temples there. I think he's a little bit older than a, you know, undergrad.
Could be. And then the shot changes, and it's really great because they show a bottle, and it's cut off, but we can still see the words poison on it. And then we see George's head pop up, you know, as he's, like, looking at this bottle to try and figure out what it is. And then he turns the bottle around and sees that he sees the word poison. Could you make out what was written on the bottle itself? Something glyceride.
Yeah, it looks like something glycerin or glyceride, EV. I don't know what the EV would stand for, evaporated glycerin. I mean, it's kind of something that dried. I'm sure it probably was once harmless. And I was thinking maybe he was filling up glycerin capsules, but he just saw the thing of glycerin and put it down and thought, I gotta put together pills. So he put that down, not realizing it was poison. Then he thought, I've got to put the diphtheria antitoxin, because they said that his customers, all the family, had diphtheria.
Right.
So although I don't think diphtheria was treated orally. I may be wrong, but I think that you had to get an injection. I may be very wrong about that. I am not a doctor, but diphtheria at the time was well under control. Paul Ehrlich, who had, you know, the magic bullet, he had come up with all these different antitoxins, and there was already a diphtheria antitoxin as well as a vaccine for the diphtheria bacteria. And immunization was huge back around like 1905 or so. So the fact that they've all come down with diphtheria sounds unusual for the time. Although there were, in the 1920s, it was estimated that 100 to 200,000 diphtheria cases and up to 15,000 deaths had occurred in the U.S. during the 1920s. So it wasn't gone. I mean, nowadays, you know, it's standard practice to give little kids the DTP, the diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, antitoxins. So you were immunized as a baby. But back then they were still making the rounds, I guess, to get people immunized against it.
That's right. That's right. So one of the biggest questions that I've always had about this movie is the fact that why is Mr. Gower giving a kid poison? You know, like, why would he do that? And forget about the fact that later on in the movie, he will actually taste it and know that it's poison. That's a separate issue. So I decided to do a little field trip. Yes. So I live in a relatively small town where, you know, there are about 12,000 people who live in my town, and we have a pharmacist, and I bump into him quite often. I see him a few times a week, usually, you know, on the street. Not that I'm going into the pharmacy.
He's not your dealer, yeah.
No, okay. No, not at all. So I decided I had a little extra time the other day, and I decided I was going to go give him a little bit of a visit. And I went there and, you know, I stood in line with everyone else. And then I went up to him and I said, all right. And I let people pass me who needed to go, you know, when a different pharmacist opened up, you know, was available. And then I went up to him and I said, all right, I'm giving you, you know, 30, I'm going to give you about a minute of free time where you don't have to worry about, you know, serving customers, because I'm now your customer. And I said, have you ever seen the movie It's a Wonderful Life? And he looks at me really strangely and he goes, you mean the one with Jimmy Stewart? I was like, yeah, that's the one. He says, yeah, I've seen it a couple of times. I said, all right, now I have a question for you. I said, do you remember it? And like, I didn't bring my laptop with me, which I probably should have, because then I could actually have shown him the scene and he probably would have said, oh, I know what that is. I know what that is. But, you know, my time was somewhat limited anyway. or his time, my time, I was free. His time was something else. And
you're
I said,
off the clock, yeah.
That's right. And I said, why would someone give poison? And he goes, well, just about everything in a pharmacy is poison. You know, that's what you use to treat diseases. You know, you're not necessarily, and that's the reason why you need a prescription. That's the reason why it's, you can't just get things over the counter. You have to have somebody who is knowledgeable in all these things in order to be able to give them to you. And he says, back nowadays, you know, you buy the pills. You know, you know, he will order the pills and he gets them. And he showed me that he even has a few locked drawers. He says, this is the really dangerous stuff that, you know, we keep it locked because we don't want people to accidentally try to take any of these toxins or anything like that. And he said that it all is based on the amount of ingredients. Okay, my assumption is, and based on what he told me, is that Mr. Gower was only supposed to put a little bit of this particular poison into creating the pills. I mean, back in 1919, the pharmacist was creating the pills themselves. You know, they weren't getting everything manufactured, which is why he has all these potions and all the little flasks,
measurements. Yeah,
exactly. It's like, okay, this is what I need to treat. I'm now going to create a little pill using all of these things. I need this percent of that and that percent of this and all those things. So what he basically said to me is that if you look at just about any drug that people are using as medicine, there is some form of ingredient that is probably poison or toxic, but because you're getting it in such small doses, the idea that it's supposed to be helping to treat whatever ailment you have, but it can you can only do that in small doses. If you do it in larger doses, then you will be causing more damage to the system. I mean, I know that a few years ago, I don't even remember what it was for. I needed some sort of medicine. And the doctor would give me the medicine for 1 month at a time, and I needed to get a blood test each time before he would give me a new prescription in order to make sure that it wasn't affecting my liver or something like that. You know, there are possible side effects of the poison itself. You know, one of the things with the human body is you know, when you put anything into the human body, whether it's poison or not, you don't know where it's going. You know, it needs to be sent to the right place.
Yeah, you're firing up like your liver and your kidneys. That their job is to cleanse you of whatever you just took. So that, you know, it's getting rid of the toxins. I lived in Pennsylvania and had a neighbor who lost her husband because he took too many. He was having some. It was like the flu or something, but he was taking too many Tylenols. He was taking too much acetaminophen at a time, and what had happened was it damaged his liver and kidneys, and he was gone in a week because if you just, you know, take too much of a simple thing like a paracetamol thing, it will kill you,
and that's over the counter.
Yeah, that's just stuff you can get. I mean, it's amazing. I know I take a thyroid medication because I don't have a thyroid anymore, but I have a pill that takes the place of my thyroid, and it is measured to the microgram as to how many I should take every day, because if I don't, my whole metabolism goes crazy. I can, you know, have damage to different organs, or I could, you know, not digest food anymore. So I keep it in a little. I'm at that age where I have the Sunday, Monday, Tuesday boxes, and I just take them at the right times. And but it's amazing how just a little tiny pill can change your whole health.
Yeah.
So that's an intriguing. Glad you have a pharmacist like.
Yeah. He said to me that if he had more time, at a certain point, he's like, all right, that's it. I need to sort of take care of other customers. And I said, oh, is that all you have to say? And he goes, no, I have tons to say, but I don't have the time to do it. He says,
yeah. He goes, I'll come back later. I'll show you how to kill people. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, to become a pharmacist, you know, there's a lot. I mean, I remember I once went to him for something, and he took out all these old pharmacy books to start looking at different ingredients and things like that, you know, to, you know, like a pharmaceutical encyclopedia or something like that that talks about all the different ingredients and stuff like that. Because I guess you also have to deal with the fact that sometimes people can be allergic or get reactions to certain certain ingredients and stuff like that. But it was fascinating talking to him about it. And I asked, this is for a later minute, but you know, I'll mention it now. I asked him, though, what would it help to taste it? And he goes, well, what does it help when you're watching a movie and you know the cops have gotten a big cocaine thing and they take it out and they lick it also? It's like you don't really necessarily know what you're tasting.
Yeah. Oh, that was bleach. Yeah.
That's right. Exactly.
My mother had she had a nerve infection on her back, and it was causing her great pain. She'd gotten rid of the infection, but she still had this. She couldn't sleep. She couldn't sleep on her back. She couldn't turn, and the doctor had given her a prescription for a nerve anesthetic called gabapentin, and usually that's taken orally. But he said, I want you to get a topical one, and he recommended something called a compounding pharmacist. And the compounding pharmacist acts like Mr. Gower. They give out pills and things, but they also do the thing with the mortar and pestle and actually grind things up. And this compounding, we had to go about 30 or 40 miles out of town. This compounding pharmacist took gabapentin pills and mixed them with a couple of chemicals, creams and things like that, and had come up with a paste and actually put it in like a toothpaste tube size dispenser. And she would go back once a month and just put just a little bit of that on her back, and it solved her the pain. It was almost like shingles the way she was describing it. She put it on at night and the pain would go away. So there's still people that work like Mr. Gower. You just kind of have to look for compounding pharmacists, I think is the technical term for them.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's actually really cool. And after George notices that there's poison here, he actually, did you notice that he looks at his hand and like scratches his hand a little bit, scratches his finger as if, okay, I now just also touch poison. You know, am I going to be okay? Have I been infected?
And notice that as we came to the conclusion that those pills are full of poison, nobody said a word.
That's
this
right.
was all just acting and editing and camera motion. But we got the whole story there. It's obviously, you know, it's a remnant of the silent era, which Capra was a part of. With all these people were a part.
That's right.
The young man wasn't, but H.B. Warner, definitely. They could express things with an emotion, you know, an eyebrow or just a tilt of the head. But just great the way the camera's moving just gently. And you know, a little pushing in, and then we go to that back office where we're looking at Mr. Gower.
Yeah, and we see all of the different potions, you know, on the shelves in front of him, and the way that the shelves are built, you know, you can see that there's one, they're like different frames, and the bottom left hand frame is Gower just staring at the picture of his son, you know, with the typewriter in the background. And it's broken up really well, the way that they show it.
And then it's almost that it's almost like that golden ratio.
Yeah,
it seems like it's divided almost perfectly for Gower, and he really is kind of the focus of that whole scene. That your eyes are kind of drawn to him.
Correct. And then the camera moves in a little bit and zooms in, and then George says to him. George stands there, and they have the diphtheria there, haven't they, sir? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, is it a charge? Yes, George. Mr. Gower, get going. Yes, sir. So a charge is basically the idea that you know, they don't have to pay cash.
You know, right, we'll bill you later.
That's right. We'll bill you later. We'll you know, when you're better, you'll pay.
Yeah.
I guess that's
long before Visa cards and things, and
that's right.
But yeah, it's just and they didn't have Amazon trucks, so it was just a kid on a bike.
Right. I mean, they have that actually in we have like small little groceries here, which do that, you know, where you have a monthly charge, where basically this way your kids can go and say, okay, we're number 6921. you know, put it on the bill. And then at the end of the month, you get the bill and then you pay the whole bill.
Wow.
You know, so it, by us, it still works that way.
Wow. Yeah. It's, I mean, it makes sense. It's kind of, you know, you're collecting things, and then it's probably easier to write one paper check, as they used to back then, than to have to keep paying every time they were going back and forth. I mean, they were long before the ATM age.
That's right.
But you know, so now we're up to this point where George is in a quandary. What does he do? He's carrying poison to a house full of sick people. What do I do now? And
I love when he walks out of the back room. He keeps looking back, as if to say, you know, wait a second. Why are you sending me to do this? I need you to help me here. You know, and
yeah.
Did you notice that in the background there's a whole bunch of I guess boxes of what's known as hair tonic.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you know what hair tonic was used for?
I used to use hair tonic. I grew up on Jarrah's Hair Trainer. Growing up, I had a haircut much like young George here, and that part would never stay in place. So, mostly it was made out of cornstarch. So it was just it made things very sticky. One time I met a fellow from, I believe it was Buffalo, New York, and he was heir to the Wild Root Hair Tonic Company, and it was a small company. he told me that he was heir, but he was in charge of in the small company that they had. It started out small and got bigger and bigger, and they wound up with a factory. But when he was a kid, he would help stir up the hair tonic. Basically, all the Wild Root hair tonic in the world was in these buckets that they'd had to stir and mix all the fragrances and the cornstarch and then get it into individual bottles. But, you know, until I guess the 70s, people, you know, this was a typical man's thing. You'd have to just get out the hair tonic and slick it back.
Well, you know, people used it also because they believed that it would stop your hair from thinning or getting split ends and things like that and help with dry scalp. You know, so there's, you know, I can see that you have more hair than I do, and so maybe the hair tonic actually helped you.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I don't know. It's every time I go to the barber, he keeps cutting off the brown parts. I just have to get him to stop because it keeps turning grayer and grayer. Now it's getting toward Leslie Nielsen white. I think I'm almost to Peter Graves level of white hair. interesting how many things were available in the store, and they all seem to be kind of blended together. I mean, the Pepto-Bismol is still right there next to the hair tonic.
That's right. Well, come on, after you know if you're worried that your hair is thinning, so then you're going to have an upset stomach.
That's probably it.
It's or it could be like the QWERTY board. You know, you don't want to have things next to each other to cause a little too much commotion. You know.
Yeah, and there's always the chloroform on the second shelf that we looked at the other day. If you're just feeling bad, just take some of that, and it'll be tomorrow pretty soon.
That's right. And then we see a shot of George looking. He puts his hat on, and then he looks out, and we see a sign hanging. And once again, you know, Capra really shows this to us visually, and we see an ad that says, "Ask Dad, he knows," and the "he" is underlined. And this is an ad for Sweet Caporal. Are you familiar with what Sweet Caporal is?
It would eventually become the American Tobacco Company, which the company below that was the ones making the Camels and the Chesterfields that we saw the other day. So it's all in that one corner. But Kinney Tobacco was
the
company there.
That's right. But the truth is it actually merged already in 1890 into the American Tobacco Company. So the question is, you know, it's been 20 years since 30 years since it became the American Tobacco Company. But I guess they still were using, you know, the brand was still, still called Sweet Caporal.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long that lasted by itself, but the Sweet Caporal was famous for – they kind of came up long before Topps trading cards. They came up with trading cards were attached to the back of every pack of cigarettes. So you could be the lucky kid that that got the whole team of a baseball team. Most famously, the Honus Wagner card was one that Sweet Caporal included on backs of their packages. Honus Wagner, a very famous non-smoker, insisted that they remove his picture from the baseball cards, and due to their, you know, they had to take them off the back of the cigarette packs and destroy them. So the remaining few Honus Wagners that are still in existence command very high prices at auctions nowadays.
Yeah, makes sense. So,
Intriguing that they, you know, I mean, I always associate baseball cards with bubblegum, but I guess their background was getting younger people to smoke cigarettes.
Yeah, it's true. That's what they wanted to do. It was the 1910 Honus Wagner card. It's the most famous collectible. It's known that way because it's because of the story that you just told. Now, does it look to you like it does to me that the man in this ad looks like Ralph Bellamy?
Yeah, I can see that. Yes, definitely. It looks. I just wonder, you know, if this is something that the art department at Liberty Films cranked out. It wasn't like this. Or, you know, at the time, it could have been a famous. It could have been a famous common ad. I don't know if that was a catchphrase. I was looking for that catchphrase from Sweet Caporal, but all the references went back to It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
So this might be just a little on the nose business by Frank Capra to say, you know, go to the Bailey Savings and Loan is probably a little too obvious. So
that's right.
They went with this.
And
you very unusual font for the time too.
I think
that script font that they had is very unusual.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. I was thinking that also. That it's strange that they use script at the time.
Yeah.
And if you look on the right-hand side below it, you see all of these pipes. They're Patterson pipes.
Mm. Oh, okay.
Which is from a company that originated in Dublin in 1865. Mm. It was known as Cap Brothers pipes, and a man named Charles Peterson showed up there. Actually, that's really interesting. It should be Peterson, not Patterson.
Hmm.
Hmm. Maybe they couldn't get the rights to it. I don't know.
Yeah, this is the Pepsi version of the. Maybe they're a knockoff that was trying to go for the discount house, and it's like it's just like a Peterson, but it's a Patterson. I was wondering, are they all the same type of pipe? It looks like they have different shaped bowls on a couple of them. So
maybe
I don't
it's
know.
Like, you know, when you go in to buy socket wrenches and you have the different sizes.
Yeah. Yeah. Give me the 10 millimeter pipe or what? But yeah, I was just wondering, I don't know if people have preferences that, do you need a deeper pipe? Do you need to hold more tobacco, or do you want something flat that gives you more smoke? Or it's, I would assume there is an entire subculture of pipe smokers who would know, you know, the Meerschaum versus the corn cob and things like that, what kind of output you're expecting from your pipe. But this looks like the kind of a thing that you'd see hanging in a convenience store to, you know, buy a plastic comb or something.
Right. So
it's just I didn't realize it was a commodity item like that.
Well, apparently back then it was. Today it is less of a commodity item. And then for some reason, George runs out of the store. He starts sprinting. Is it because he knows he needs to get the poison to the boy, or he needs to catch his father before he's, in a busy meeting that he can't interrupt?
Yeah, he just, who do I trust? I'll ask Dad. And leaving, did Mary ever pay for her ice cream?
No, she did not.
I didn't notice.
She did not.
I didn't notice any money changing hands there.
Well, would you pay for an ice cream that you asked for without coconut and it was covered in shreds of coconut?
No tip for that kid. No way.
That's right. Oh, well, she doesn't want to give him a tip. She just wants to marry him. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if she'd tell Mr. Gower, you know, he put pot. No, she probably overheard the whole conversation. So it's like, I just better sneak out of here.
Yeah.
But yeah, just very peculiar of what, you know, I guess she's just watching what's happening next.
That's right. And you see that she has the full thing of ice cream in front of her, and you still see it overflowing with coconut on top.
just whole, you know, all of Tahiti's yearly crop is probably just sitting there. I'll show her. I'll just triple up the coconut. But she
she was polite enough. She was polite enough to not throw it back at him.
Yeah, I'm just wondering while Mr. Gower is staring at his son's picture, if she was going to just go and clean up after it. She seems the type to do that.
Well, we do know that she's still there when George comes back and gets slapped.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, walloped, I think.
Walloped is a better word. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So I guess she's just going to – I'll have to tune in later to a later minute and find out if she ever polished off that coconut with a light dusting of chocolate on it.
My assumption is not.
Well, we get back to the Harry Potter stagecoach. I mean, that's Mr. Right. Potter's the stagecoach with the rather funereal-looking chauffeur on the top.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's just sitting there waiting.
He really is not. Yeah. I'm just going to pull on the reins and keep the horses steady.
That's right. And he gets there pretty quick. You know, he runs out of the store, and the next thing he knows, he's right in front of the bailing and loan. And we know from later in the movie that there is a little bit of a distance between Mr. Gower's drugstore and the building and loan.
I do enjoy the building and loans business directory, which seems to be written on the stairs themselves. As you can see, there is a collection service. So some, you know, picking up deadbeat payments for not, you know, paying your bill at Mr. Gower's. You're going to see the guy on the first floor, I guess. Definitely. And then there's the Bailey Savings and Loan Association. There is an ear, nose, and throat doctor who's probably – he should have run in and asked the ear, nose, and throat doctor about, is this stuff going to kill your diphtheria patients? That might have been a way around it. Also a place for a veterinarian and a real estate and jewelry company. I don't know. Is it a pawn shop? Where would you buy both real estate and jewelry?
It probably is a pawn shop.
Yeah. Here's the deed to an apartment across town.
That's right.
Oh, and here's a bracelet. But yeah, it's very peculiar. I just wonder how many people are using those stairs every day, because it just seems like a very varied.
Always look at what's written on the stairs when you walk by?
I guess you'd say, aha. I mean, it's instant advertising.
That's right.
So I was just wondering about the ear, nose, and throat guy who is next to the veterinarian. So if you're allergic to cats and you're going to see your doctor, you're not going to have a good day.
There you go. Hey, it works. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. So there seems to be five tenants there, not including Anderson's store on the first floor.
Right.
And you probably want to make note of that, listeners, because we're gonna be looking at some geography later on in the show in the week as it goes on.
Definitely. And then George runs up the stairs, and the camera actually zooms in on him as he starts climbing up the stairs.
Well, yeah, and actually, if you're looking carefully at this as it moves, it's a combination of a tilt of the camera, and then it's an optical zoom. They actually enlarge a still picture of the Bailey Brothers Building and Loan Association. It's very subtle, but it's not a camera move. It's not a tilt. I mean, the tilt is there, but it's the tilt and I think the tilt and the zoom are both in camera effect. I think it's an optical printer that did that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
It has a strobing effect, which it wouldn't do if it were in a it was an actual camera move.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes
right. My understanding is that there's a lot of times in this movie that Capra basically enlarges the picture, you know, but they did that all post production. Yeah, which is why some things are a little more grainy. Exactly.
Yeah, the grain changes there, and but it, you know, it got the job done. He needed the shot that he didn't get when he was out on the set.
That's right.
So off George goes.
yes.
Into Tomorrowland. Yes.
Correct.
But a lot of camera stuff. A lot of interesting editing choices and acting in this part. The cinematographer really shined in this particular minute.
Yes, I completely agree with you on that. Okay, so you know that's the way we end this minute. Is there anything else you wanted to mention about the minute?
I'm good. It was great.
You know, the only thing I wanted to point out is as he's running out of the story, you can see that there are two issues of the Saturday Evening Post.
Yes.
Sitting out there.
Yes.
Which was a magazine that published weekly between 1897 and 1963. And then until 1969, it was then done biweekly. And nowadays, it's only published six times a year.
Wow.
And it's filled with fiction, nonfiction, cartoons, features. And they had a subscriber list that reached more than 2 million homes every week.
Wow. Yeah, that was the nation's discussion place, or you know, things light reading for people at home that you know they could talk about over the fence during the week, in the days before radio and after radio.
That's so, right.
The bottom the bottom illustration on the bottom copy of the Saturday Evening Post is an illustration done by Norman Rockwell, who became almost synonymous with Saturday Evening Post. I've seen many of the original artworks there. There's a Rockwell Museum in Massachusetts, and it's built on Norman Rockwell's his farm, where he had a studio, and he had a studio. His home was there, and built after a rather large fire. His house had been destroyed before. It's out in western Massachusetts in Stockbridge. Well worth a trip if you're anywhere in New England to see this, because it is the most complete collection of Norman Rockwell illustrations. And I was frankly surprised at the size of the originals of these. These are almost, I would say, 5-to-1 or 4-to-1 reductions on this on the front of the cover. They are massive, bigger than maybe as big as movie posters.
Oh wow!
They're very, very large illustrations. One of his most famous collections was the Four Freedoms, which he drew during World War II, and I believe each one of the Four Freedoms paintings are either 6 or 7 feet tall. They're displayed in one room, and they are just massive. And I mean, most people have seen Norman Rockwell illustrations, but when you're looking at the original work that he did, the detail work on this full size is why those illustrations look so great when they shrink them down to put on the cover of a magazine. But they are just it's an amazing talent that he had to capture emotions, much like Capra. He had kind of the Capricorn idea. They're idealized portraits of early America, of you know, or America at the turn of the century. Right. Most of his the paintings that he did were a little bit before when he was drawing them. So if he was in the 1930s, he was drawing the 1910s, and if he was drawing the 40s, it was the 20s. But you know, the range that he lived, he was painting well into the early 70s. And it's just kind of jarring that you're looking at these pictures where he's drawing a bunch of kids, with towels wrapped around them, running away from a no swimming sign that they're escaping, you know, from whoever owned the pond, that they're running away from a swimming hole. And at the same time, you can see him drawing astronauts John Young and Gus Grissom as they prepared for the first manned Gemini flight in 1965. And it's all part of history, but it's just kind of jarring when you see things from what would be considered contemporary for, you know, the 60s. It's just an unusual. He continued capturing that American spirit in his illustrations through his entire life. Just a fascinating place. Again, Rockwell Museum, Stockbridge, Massachusetts. If you ever get a chance, it is worth your time.
All right. Excellent. So every Thursday we have a segment called James Stewart Thursday, where my guests will give their top five Jimmy Stewart films. So, Jim, why don't you start off with number five and work your way up?
Okay, I would start off with a fascinating casting against – well, Jimmy Stewart, he had such a range. He played so many different parts. He was kind of – I think where Tom Hanks is in his career now, Jimmy Stewart had that same wide range of different characters he was playing. Usually, you know, he's playing good guys. He's playing bad guys. He was in comedies, lots of comedies, but lots of drama too. One of my favorite ones, one of my five favorite ones, would be Anatomy of a Murder, which I think was in 1959 or 16 or there.
59.
And Otto Preminger directed it. Otto Preminger is known for pushing the envelope as to what he's going to put on the screen. Has very strong language. Lee Remick is the is in this, and it's about Ben Gazzara is being on trial for murder. And his defense was the man that he killed had raped his wife. And it was the actual use of the term rape, along with a lot of other
I mean, the movie even makes light of it, because, you know, at one point they use the word panties, and everyone in the gallery, you know, start laughing, and the judge says, "Look, you know, this is what this is about. Grow up." Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to use terms here that people are not used to, and that's it, you know, or that people are not used to staying in public.
Yeah, and the Motion Picture Association had to change their code to let this out. I mean, this was and I think it went into if I remember correctly, it went into a lawsuit, and it wound up in front of a court, and the court said, well, these are all scientific terms that we use in a regular courtroom, so it's not slanderous and it's not obscene. And they let it go. It was condemned by different religious groups, and there were people trying to boycott the movie. But it's a very compelling film. I think it's one of George C. Scott's early supporting roles.
Mm-hmm.
George C. Scott is fantastic in it. If you get to see this film, it's great. He's the camera shots that Preminger uses. There's a defense attorney, which is Stewart, and there's a prosecuting attorney, which is George C. Scott. And as each of them take turns being strong in the court case, they move in front of each other and argue. And it's just very, very strong diagonal dynamics of this film. It's well worth your time. All of these movies I'm going to say is well worth your time. But it's just interesting seeing Jimmy Stewart playing in such a dramatic, no-holds-barred type of film. So I strongly recommend that.
Mm-hmm.
Next up, and this is a very – I mean – this is fourth, but it may be fifth, because it's a sequel, and I usually like sequels. Sometimes do good. Sequels are hit and miss. I mean, I could say the biggest hit sequel would have been Empire Strikes Back, and then maybe Rambo. But this sequel was after The Thin Man, which I don't want to give too much away from this, but it does play. Let me just say it plays Jimmy Stewart against type. And they brought back all the original characters from The Thin Man. One of my favorite movie couples on screen is William Powell and Myrna Loy. They have such
Nick and Nora.
Anybody who's been married knows what that relationship is like. It's you have fun with your spouse, you trust your spouse, but you have these little tug of wars, and you have little shorthands for things, and they do it so well you could swear William Powell and Myrna Loy were married, but that never happened. And this is the further adventures of The Thin Man, which people can think it's William Powell. It's like doing the Frankenstein thing. It's got nothing to do with William Powell being the Thin Man. He's not it. But again, another locked door murder mystery, and Jimmy Stewart plays a very innocent looking guy in this thing, but he may have some secrets up his sleeve, and he may be hiding something. He may be protecting somebody. So I don't want to give it away. If you haven't seen it, please go see After The Thin Man. It is an enjoyable, as they say in the movie critic circles, romp. So let's see. After that, I would say there's a bunch of Hitchcock movies you can pick from. But my favorite, Jimmy Stewart, you know, Jimmy Stewart, like The Man Who Knew Too Much or Vertigo and things like that. My favorite Jimmy Stewart being in a Hitchcock movie would be Rear Window. Rear Window, Paramount Pictures, all shot as a – it's almost like a stage play. They took out the inside of a Paramount soundstage and turned it into a courtyard of a couple of apartment houses. Jimmy Stewart is he's home. He's a photographer for a news service. He's got a broken leg. He can't move. And so he believes he's seen a murder, and he's seen someone getting away with murder and hiding a body. It's up to him to talk his girlfriend, astonishingly, I mean, she's just glowing, Grace Kelly, in this film. It's one of her best performances. And you're following along, and he never gets out of his wheelchair except toward the end. But it's just an amazing single room shot that you're following all these different stories going on in the apartments around him. Jimmy Stewart is great at – I mean, he does perfect Hitchcock. Hitchcock always has the most ghastly script ideas. And he was talking – there's a wonderful conversation that Jimmy Stewart has with Grace Kelly, where he's trying to decide if you're going to have a body – and you were going to chop it up and hide it in a box, would you start at the head or would you start at the feet? And he goes about it like the way you were talking about packing luggage. It's just so, you know, it's so morbid, but it's hilarious and scary all at the same time. It's a perfect blend of Hitchcockian type scripts. So I would put that at number three. Second classic, it's the role that I think one of the roles that Jimmy Stewart was born for, is Harvey, 1950 Harvey. It's based on the stage play, and his version of Elwood P. Dowd, this guy who sees he sees giant rabbits and a giant rabbit, his friend named Harvey, and he's a very simple, loving man who the world doesn't accept that he can see an invisible rabbit, and his trauma with his sisters and his girlfriend in trying to decide how do we make him not be so crazy. It's great. Some of the characters, some of the same people that Capra had hired in Arsenic and Old Lace return in this film, and they are just hilarious.
Well, he does that in many of his films. You know, most directors do that. They even do that nowadays. You know, the people that they're used to working with, and it's fun to work. They have their
company almost.
That's
yeah.
right, their company.
It's a little entourage of people that follow them around. And he really knows their greatest strength, so he puts them in roles that they can do their thing. And it's this movie. My mom saw Harvey on Broadway, the play Harvey, and she talked about how when you're watching this and Elwood P. Dowd is telling you about what Harvey's like, there's a scene in the play where Elwood looks across the stage and yells, "Harvey!" And a light turns on the right-hand side of the screen, on the right side of the stage, and a door opens and slams, and she said, "I think half the people in the theater thought they saw a rabbit because it was it was so believable the way he was presenting this invisible rabbit." So, if it's I think Harvey's one of my favorite pukas, the Irish he's a trickster. Yeah, I'd say Harvey would be my second favorite Jimmy Stewart film. One of my favorite, I think my favorite Jimmy Stewart movie. It's not the lead role.
I know where you're going. Let me see if I'm right.
Okay.
I don't know. Okay. I know you talk about one of your favorite roles, a lot during Apollo 13. Is that where you're going here or not?
No. This is going to surprise you then.
Okay.
Yeah,
I thought you were going with Strategic Air Command. That's where I thought you were going.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, we're going way late. We're going into the 70s, and I'm not talking about Airport 77. That's just he was checking a box so he could qualify for the SAG hospitalization plan. But my favorite role for Jimmy Stewart, and it's just a small role, but it's key, and he has such interactions with so many other classic stars from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. He plays a doctor in 1901, and he is friends with an old gunfighter who he would patch up and send out on yet another mission. And this was 1976. Dino De Laurentiis, of all people, Dino De Laurentiis' movie The Shootist.
I knew that. I knew this was true.
Yeah, John Wayne. John Wayne's last film. Ron Howard's in it. Imagine a Ron Howard, John Wayne film. And Richard Boone's in it. And Jimmy Stewart. And Jimmy Stewart has to lay it out, and as well as Lauren Bacall is in this movie. And Jimmy Stewart has to lay it out for John Wayne that it's 1901, and he has inoperable cancer, and it's going to be a very painful death. And you can feel every emotion as he's telling John Wayne that he would not want to go out the way he's going to go out. But you get the feeling that he's also saying goodbye to the Duke himself. And, you know, Jimmy Stewart was Destry Rides Again and all these other ones, but he wandered all those Western sets. He was as much a part of the Westerns as John Wayne was. I think he may have been in the same number of Westerns. But you really feel he's saying goodbye to an entire genre in that film. And it's so compelling. And a lot of times Jimmy Stewart plays Jimmy Stewart in a movie, but he's not playing Jimmy Stewart in this. He's playing an old doctor friend of John Wayne. And I really was very moved by it. It's one of my favorite Westerns. It's up there with Silverado. It's up there with Stagecoach. It's up there with The Searchers. It has such heart in it, and there's a very big economy of script. He says a couple of words. It's all in the facial expressions, the eyebrows, the wave of a hand. And it is, like, I know I say this a lot, but it is worth your time to see The Shootist and just realize you're seeing some super veteran. This is like the all-star game of Western, seeing them there saying goodbye to their careers, actually, because most of them didn't, you know. John Carradine is in it too. There's so many people that just come out of the woodwork and you're like, holy smoke. Harry Morgan's in it. And
Harry Morgan's in everything. Come on.
Yeah. And it's just, they keep coming out and you're like, look who that is. But it's such a beautiful film, and it really is a great way of saying goodbye to an entire generation of shootists, of Westerners. So that would be my top. Jimmy Stewart's like the cherry on top. He does a great job in it. So that's my five.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much for that. So, Jim, you want to tell people where they can get in touch with you?
Easy to find me. Hard to spell. It's jimokane.com, JIMOKANE.com. You can follow, and there's happy trails in there all the way to all my podcasts, all my different video things, TVDads.com, a lot of stuff about space, and anything that I find in my desk drawers, I eventually winds up on that website. So check it out, JimOKane.com, for all your Jim O'Kane needs.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe to any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.